perspective is from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading drop in life expectancy speaks volumes about how U.S. handled COVID, experts says. Here's the details. Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021, which followed a well-documented drop in 2020 and contrasted a recovery trend in other high-income countries. The paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, shows that U.S. life expectancy fell from 78.86 years in 2019 to 76.99 years in 2020 and 76.60 years in 2021, a net loss of 2.26 years. The study comes as progressives in Congress continue to fight for Medicare for All legislation to replace the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, one in which 112 million adults struggle to afford care, according to Gallup and Wealth Health. The research also comes just days after a Poor People's Campaign analysis exposed how the public health crisis was twice as deadly in poor countries as in healthy ones and exacerbated pre-existing social and economic disparities that have long festered in the United States. Johns Hopkins University's case tracker reported that recently, COVID-19 had claimed 984,571 lives across the United States of America, or nearly 16% of the more than 6 million deaths globally. Dr. Stephen Wolf, co-author of the new study and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, said in a statement that we already knew that the U.S. experienced historic losses in life expectancy in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What wasn't clear is what happened in 2021. Early in 2021, knowing an excellent vaccine was being distributed, I was hopeful that the U.S. could recover some of its historic losses, said Wolf, adding, but I began to worry more when I saw what happened as the year unfolded. He said, even so, as a scientist, until I saw the data, it remained an open question how U.S. life expectancy for that year would be affected. It was shocking to see that U.S. life expectancy, rather than having rebounded, had dropped even further. In addition to examining the United States, the researchers looked at life expectancy over the past 2 years in 19 peer countries and found a smaller drop between 2019 and 2020, an average of 57/10 years, followed by an average 28/10 year increase from 2020 to 2021. While other high-income countries saw their life expectancy increase in 2021, recovering about half of their losses, U.S. life expectancy continued to fall, Wolf said, adding, this speaks volumes about the life consequences of how the U.S. handled the pandemic. Taking aim at policymakers who opposed efforts to curb the spread of the virus, the expert added that in a country where U.S. Constitution and 10th Amendment grant public health authority to the states, I believe the U.S. catastrophe speaks volumes about the policies and behaviors of U.S. governors, at least some of them. A highly effective vaccine was available in 2021 that made COVID-19 deaths almost completely preventable. Wolf highlighted that while the Delta and Omicron variants significantly contributed to the death toll in the United States, those mutations also impacted other countries that saw life expectancy rates rebound last year. He said deaths from these variants occurred almost entirely among unvaccinated people. What happened in the U.S. is less about the variants than the levels of resistance to vaccination and the public's rejection of practices such as masking and mandates to reduce viral transmission. Noting high rates of heart disease and obesity as well as inequities in access to healthcare in the United States, lead author and University of Colorado Boulder sociology professor Ryan Master said that those same factors made the U.S. more vulnerable than other countries to the mortality consequences of COVID-19. The study states that over a two-year period between 2019 and 2021, U.S. Hispanic and non-Hispanic black populations experienced the largest losses in life expectancy, reflecting the legacy of systematic racism and inadequacies in the U.S. handling of the pandemic. Wolf said that sadly, it was not a surprise to see the disproportionate impact on people of color. Our research had shown previously, but there was an interesting plot twist in 2021. The only decrease in life expectancy occurred in white people. Life expectancy in the black population even increased. Despite that increase, he pointed out, life expectancy in the black population remains far lower than in other groups, but the disproportionate impact on white people holds clues to what happened in 2021. Co-author Ladan Aron, a senior fellow at Urban Institute, told The Washington Post, "It's hard to imagine that willingness to be vaccinated is not a piece of that puzzle. The life expectancy gap between the United States and its peer-income countries is now over 5 years, which is an incredible gap," she said. Death and life expectancy? That's the ultimate marker of what it means to live in a country. The new research comes after a March study published in the journal Population and Development Review, which found that global life expectancy appears to have declined by 92-tenths years between 2019 and 2020, and by another 72-tenths years between 2020 and 2021. Changes in life expectancy between 2019 and 2020 in America, Europe, and a few other countries have received copious attention.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. no remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancé says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept the reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kiev had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment, and it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project, dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to, prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia. So that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British and these days by the Americans as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
There is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carle. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. It's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors. NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic crisis since its 1948 independence from the United Kingdom. The economic downturn has led to long lines for fuel, a short supply of essential goods, and seven-hour-long power cuts every day. The protesters are calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The president, however, remains defiant. He declared a state of emergency on Friday and announced a curfew to quell the protests. However, the demonstrations show no sign of dying down anytime soon. The government blames the COVID-19 pandemic for the devaluation of the national currency and other economic woes. It says the outbreak has slashed revenues from tourism and the inward flow of foreign exchanges. But that's not the whole picture, at least according to economic experts.
The situation has been exacerbated in Sri Lanka due to the mismanagement, the political crisis, the corruption. The president and the prime minister are brothers. One of the nephews is a minister in the government. So it's, you know, it's extraordinary sort of nepotism which is happening in Sri Lanka. So that's one of the contributory factors.
A government expenditure that exceeds its income, ill-timed tax cuts, and a sudden shift toward organic farming that hamstrung the food industry in the country are also cited as reasons why the Sri Lankan economy is now in the doldrums. Sri Lanka is facing imminent default with over $7 billion of debt due this year, $1 billion of which are international bonds that will mature in July. This is while the country's usable currency reserves are estimated to have fallen to as low as $500 million. To stave off defaulting on its debt, Colombo has turned to regional superpowers, India and China, for bailout loans, securing a $1 billion credit line from the New Delhi late last month. But that's far from enough, which leaves Sri Lanka with not many more alternatives than the International Monetary Fund. But securing a loan from the IMF will come at a cost too, as the international lender would require Sri Lanka to implement fundamental changes to its fiscal and economic policies, something that experts believe would put much more pressure on the poor. Besides, as some commentators suggest, the demanded restructuring could infringe on Colombo's sovereignty.
As soon as IMF loans money to any nation, they want austerity measures. What that means in simple language is they want subsidies to be taken away from basic things that ordinary people use. Because what you've got to remember that in a developing country like Sri Lanka, the main budget of the ordinary masses is on food and accommodation and energy. They don't have any sort of residual income to buy luxuries. And if inflation goes up by 40% in these sectors, then it has a huge impact on the ordinary people.
No matter what route the country will choose, one thing is for certain. As long as the current economic climate stands, the developing nations would suffer under skyrocketing consumer prices, fuel shortages, and power cuts, which means more protests and political uncertainty in the indebted nations.
The holy month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radena said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when the Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets, and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained. Israeli forces have recently intensified their violent raids on Palestinian cities and villages. A fresh escalation erupted after Palestinian gunmen, angry over the regime's crimes and occupation, killed 11 Israelis in separate attacks. That's the sharpest spike in attacks on city streets in years. On Tuesday, a Palestinian shot dead 5 people in a suburb of Tel Aviv before he was killed by Israeli forces. The operation came days after 2 Palestinian gunmen killed 2 Israeli forces and wounded 4 others in a shooting attack in the northern Israeli city of Hadera before being shot dead. The latest round of escalations could lead to igniting another war between Israel and Palestine. Last year, protests against the illegal eviction of Palestinians from the homes in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah during Ramadan ignited an 11-day Israeli offensive on Gaza in May. At least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment. On the Israeli side, 12 people, including 2 children, were killed.
What's needed in order to do real resistance there is to make Israel extremely uncomfortable, and to the extent that they have to change their policies, or basically just hopefully it'll be so uncomfortable that they'll have to leave, which is of course what happened in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, and in Algeria. The occupier left. And this needs to be the goal for Palestinians in order to the goal of their resistance.
The Israeli regime has for years guaranteed its security by attacking Palestinians. But now things have changed and Palestinian people and resistance groups are ready to retaliate.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Once I spoke in details about national self-confidence, another element is the solidity of national faith. There are certain principles which our people believe in. This faith caused our people to stand up against the bullets of the Taghuti regime's military and overthrow the regime during a time when they did not have any weapons. In most cases, they did not even have stones to throw. That was due to faith. National faith is a really valuable asset. The preservation of national faith is one of the assets that is related to the people. Other elements include public welfare and smoothness of social matters. Mr. President, explained your opinions as voiced in the annual meeting of the Assembly. One important issue in the management of the country and the public life of the people is for the facilitation of their issues. They must not face hurdles and obstacles.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
For instance, the honorable officials of the country decided to create a consolidated window for investment and business affairs. Such measures are good. Affairs must be carried out smoothly and easily. These are matters that concern the people. If these things are done, the people's presence on the scene will be ensured. That is, if we can resolve these matters that are directly related to the people, then their presence on the scene will be 100%. Of course, despite the fact that we have certain problems right now, the people are present on the scene. Even in the 1980s, during the Sacred Defense era, when there were many problems, the people were present on the scene. There is no doubt about this. But if these things are resolved, the people will unanimously be present on the scene. And when people show their presence, no country and nation will have any concern and fear of anybody. Because the people's presence is very important and because their presence is dependent on such matters. You can see how big and small devils are trying to deceive the people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
in the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is believed to be considering a ministerial reshuffle this summer or autumn. There are known to have been tensions between No. 10 and No. 11 Downing Street after the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, offered only lukewarm support to Boris Johnson at the height of the scandal over lockdown-busting parties. We now present you an article written by Toby Helm. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Top Tories Say Rishi Sunak's Hopes of Becoming UK's Prime Minister Are Over. Senior British Conservatives have written off the Chancellor Rishi Sunak as a potential Prime Minister and now believe Boris Johnson will have to remove him as Chancellor of the Exchequer in his next reshuffle, following the furore over his US green card and his wife's tax affairs. One former Tory minister told The Guardian that the fear among Conservative MPs with small majorities was that the party was now in a death spiral, with its two leading figures, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, both having lost respect among voters. After Rishi Sunak's multi-millionaire wife, Akshata Murthy, agreed to pay UK tax on her global fortune, having avoided doing so under rules that apply to people who opt for non-domiciled status, the ex-minister said, "The worry is that this is symptomatic of a party in terminal decline and that we are in a death spiral." Referring to the entire controversy and revelations about the couple having had US green cards, the former minister added, "This is the concern of colleagues with small majorities." The former minister noted, "He has shown colossal naivety, and the way he has arranged his affairs does not suggest he's even committed to the UK, but that he is keeping open the option of a career in finance in the United States." On Friday, 8th of April, it also emerged that the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, and his wife, Akshata Murthy, had both held US green cards, meaning they had registered themselves as permanent residents in the United States. In a development that shocked many Tories, it was confirmed that Sunak held the green card for a period of 19 months, when he was Chancellor and in charge of UK finances. The issue was even raised at a White House briefing on Friday evening. The former Tory cabinet minister said Rishi Sunak was clearly damaged and would not stand any chance in a leadership contest if one was held in the coming months. He said the way he had arranged his family's affairs had shown his political judgment to be badly flawed and raised questions about whether his leadership chances could ever be revived. A third senior figure in the Conservative Party said the controversy of recent days had demonstrated how quickly a once stellar career could go into reverse, to a point from which it would be difficult to recover. The official said, "The timing is terrible. I think his problem is that taxes have gone up a lot in this period as Chancellor, which is not popular in the party or the country, and we have a cost of living crisis. None of this looks good." It was reported that removal vans had been seen in Downing Street on Saturday, 9th of April, and that Akshata Murthy and the two children would live at their West London home, with Rishi Sunak remaining at No. 11 Downing Street during the working week. Boris Johnson is believed to be considering a ministerial reshuffle this summer or autumn. There are known to have been tensions between No. 10 and No. 11 after the Chancellor offered only lukewarm support to Boris Johnson at the height of the scandal over lockdown-busting parties. A government source said, "I don't see the Prime Minister resisting this opportunity to remove Rishi now." The latest opinion poll for The Guardian has found that Rishi Sunak's approval rating has dropped to a new low of -15%, making him only slightly less unpopular than Boris Johnson himself. Only 4 months ago, when he was firm favourite to succeed Boris Johnson if the Prime Minister was toppled over parties at number 10, the Chancellor's approval rating stood at a very healthy +11%. All opposition parties are now determined to keep up pressure on the Chancellor Rishi Sunak in the coming weeks. Labour and the Liberal Democrats called on Rishi Sunak's wife, Akshata Murthy, who remains an Indian citizen, not just to begin paying tax on her overseas earnings, but also to pay back what she had saved over recent years. Shadow Transport Secretary Louise Haig said that while her non-dom status had been legal, Sunak, who claimed recently that she was victim of a smear campaign, had failed to be transparent about his family's tax status at a time when he was raising taxes for millions of Britons. She said, "He has come out on a number of occasions to try and muddy the waters around this and to obfuscate." In a statement on Friday, 8th of April, Akshata Murthy, who is to keep India as her place of domicile, said she had done nothing wrong but acknowledged some people did not see her tax status as being compatible with her husband's position. She said, "I understand and appreciate the British sense of fairness, and I do not wish my tax status to be a distraction for my husband or to affect my family. I do this because I want to, not because the rules require me to." By retaining her non-domicile status, she will in future be able to save huge sums in inheritance tax. Akshata Murthy has assets of at least £690 million in her father's company, Infosys. The Liberal Democrats have drawn up draft legislation aimed at forcing the Chancellor and any other government ministers to reveal whether they or their spouses claim non-domicile status or have holdings in overseas tax havens. Daniel Beasley, a researcher with the charity Spotlight on Corruption, said, "The fact that Rishi Sunak had a blind trust through which his financial interests were handed over to an independent trustee raised issues over potential conflicts of interest." Daniel Beasley added, "By having this arrangement in place, Sunak is preventing any proper scrutiny of his financial interests and is the only current member of the cabinet taking this approach. The system of blind trust needs to be rethought to include at least a summary of their contents if they are relevant to a minister's brief, to give the public a better understanding of any potential conflicts of interest."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
As voters go to the first round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say, no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence. Keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Big question I get asked. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Saville for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Saville seems surprising.
It's remarkable that they didn't call upon the services of a professional PR company and they sought the services of Jimmy Savile. It just goes to show the lack of judgment and the lack of understanding of the potential for this kind of blowback when they cavort with these celebrities, not knowing anything about their background or not even trying to look into their background before they do so. We are talking about the royal family after all, aren't we?
These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without. At a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps, the association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
Just days after a UN-backed truce came into force in Yemen, fears have risen over the implementation of the agreement, with key promises regarding commercial flights being allowed to enter Sana'a's international airport failing to materialize so far. At the time of the UN announcement, senior Yemeni officials warned onlookers to remain cautious about raising their hopes prematurely. Despite the warning, many Yemenis have already become excited for an end to the war.
The truce is wonderful for us and the region in general, a great thing, and we hope that the truce will last not only for 2 months, but rather permanently, because the people are tired and they have suffered a lot.
Yemenis have faced their fair share of disappointment over the years in regards to peace efforts. Multiple nationwide ceasefires have all failed, and the 2018 peace talks hosted by Sweden also failed to produce an end to the conflict. However, experts still believe the flights will begin soon.
The truce is holding very well. Reports of violations do not amount to breaking the truce. It's the usual standard violations that take place in similar situations. The Saudis have been trying to get out of this quagmire for a long time. And the big major conference in Riyadh is their way to initiate the exit out of the Yemen conflict. So I'm very hopeful that this will lead to some major break in the Yemeni conflict.
This truce, which the United Nations is already celebrating, could turn into a curse rather than a blessing for millions of Yemenis if key pledges regarding the siege are not upheld. In particular, so many will be hoping that they can finally get into Yemen to visit their besieged loved ones. If that turns out not to be the case, then it would be another additional heartbreak on top of